my pleasure to introduce Professor Michael Northcott. He's spent most of his career at the University of Edinburgh, but he has lived, I think, in Borneo or Southeast Asia and travelled there a fair bit. I'm sure he'll tell you if I make some kind of error. We had lunch together any time we met. Geography is the new theology, by which I think he meant that theologians used to do all kinds of different research in science, physics, ecology, chemistry, ethics, law, and now it's really in geography department really like that mix of disciplines. And so I think Michael's own work in kind of ethics, Christian ethics, ecology, political economy, cuts across lots of what lots of us do here. And so I think it's going to be a really interesting and stimulating talk. So further ado, I'll hand over.
Great,
to Michael.
Thanks so much, Mark. Yeah, it was really delightful to have lunch with three geographers, and I find that we read the same books and basically study the same thing. So maybe I'm in the wrong school, I don't know, but anyway, nice to be in geography school. I have worked in a geography school, in a geosciences school in Duke University in 2005. It was a very enlightening part of my career. So so I've called this talk Biofuels, Ancestral Time, rather than Capital Time, and the Destruction of Borneo, and that's a logging blockade by native peoples in Sarawak. I used to live in Malaysia in the 1980s and done some field work there then, and I've done more since. So some of you probably know that the European Commission Renewable Energy Directive requires that 10% of liquid fuels should be in European petrol and diesel tanks, vehicular tanks mainly, by 2020. So if you drive around Europe, you see these signs, biodiesel, makes you feel you're doing something for the planet, you know, it must be green, it's bio. This is to meet EU treaty obligations and the obligations of particular nations, of course, because they're not actually EU obligations, but the EU has an oversight of national obligations to meet Kyoto Protocol and now Paris Accord 2015 targets in terms of reductions of the per nation and hence the collective EU greenhouse gas emissions. Now, ECRED, so that's the European Commission Renewable Energy Directive, I'm going to quote that from now on, claims that biofuels and bioliquids help guarantee a real carbon savings and protect biodiversity. But the biofuels market leads directly and indirectly, and there's plenty of research on this now, to land use conversion, including from tropical forests to oil palm, soya, and corn. So if you look at these graphs, this is actually in Brazil, but it's quite clear that there's a significant leap from 2000 onwards, and it gets even bigger from about 2005-6, which reflects the take-up in the US, in the European Union, but of course also in Brazil, of a growing amount of agricultural land and products for fueling vehicles. And so clearly there is an impact on the trend towards biofuels on land use. And a recent study by, well, not that recent, a few years ago, can biofuels be a solution to climate change, the implications of land use change related to emissions policy? They found that there was a great deal going on in land use conversion all over the world. And this paper, this is just a summary of that little kind of data, how they pulled it all together. But they basically found that when you looked at the claimed GHG savings against a time horizon, the actual savings are much lower than they are said to be. And this is mainly because of direct and indirect changes in land use. But these are, of course, mediated by things like world commodity prices, production of biofuel, and so on. So there clearly is an issue. And interestingly, the trade company's own figures reflect that there is an issue. So this is figures from an oil palm company, TPB. I'm sorry, I can't remember what it stands for. I'm sure you can Google it for the talk. They're showing you where their oil palm plantations are in Malaysia, so over in Sabah, all the lowland areas of Sabah, Sarawak, and even some highland areas in Sarawak, and then quite a bit also in West Malaysia. The West Malaysian ones, particularly ones in Johor, were planted by the British. They're very old. And when the British began it, it was very much cooking oil they were after, and detergents. It wasn't, there was nobody was thinking of putting are creating diesel from oil palm in those days. And they're quite orderly plantations. I've been on the big one in Johor. But of course, in fact, the same thing is happening in West Malaysia as in East Malaysia, that the oil palm is spreading. And again, they're quite fairly open. I mean, here, another one, right in the heart of the spine of West Malaysia, you have oil palm plantation and highland area as here. Now, as it happens, as this is a kind of side point, but West Malaysia is the most biodiverse region in the whole of Southeast Asia. So it's hugely significant that large areas of West Malaysia, as well as Borneo, are turning into oil palm. West Malaysia is even more biodiverse than Borneo. It's far more biodiverse than Sumatra. Now, there may be people here who could explain why, but I think partly it is. It's sort of, it's a weird combination of an island, you see, and yet it's connected geographically, contiguously to Paris. So that's a very unusual combination. That's my theory, a layman's theory for why it's so biodiverse. But it's extraordinarily biodiverse. So every time I go back, I see more oil palm. And this is the country I used to live in. I used to live here. I used to visit here. And it's kind of shocking. But the statistics here, this company, they show you the number of immature plantations. That'll be like less than 10 years by hectares. And it's very significant. So that's roughly 40% of this company hectare is immature. And it's clearly, last 10 years, that's in the time when the rice market has been growing. So this is another company. This is Sung Ling, which is the biggest company in Malaysia. And again, they are showing you where they are. And of course, Malaysia is now expanding. Malaysia companies are expanding into the whole region. So they're going into Sumatra in a big way, particularly central Sumatra. Huge amount of burning going on every year here, affecting Singapore, Kuala Lumpur, the region. But they're also spreading north. And of course, perhaps most shopping, they're going into Myanmar, which is the most poorly governed region in Southeast Asia, hugely corrupt, open to any way to make money from what doesn't belong actually to the government. Except that they claim it does. Now, of course, you know, I lived in this area, and I'm Kent, you know. I knew kind of apple trees, you know, and oaks, but I really, really just sort of fell in love with rainforest. It's hard to explain. I mean, some of you might have had the same experience, but I just found it absolutely amazing, wondrous, magnificent place to be. I mean, you don't really need to wear anything to protect yourself, in my experience. I mean, it's kind of, you can jump in rivers and then go walking and then hang around in the evening, and maybe you'll see a tapir or get up really early when you hear the call of the lemurs, you know, in the trees. I mean, the clouds rising off the forest. It is the most unbelievable environment, including an environment to take your kids, which I used to often do. And jumping in rivers or waterfalls. There are no piranhas in the Malaysian tropical rainforest. I know there aren't very many crocodiles either, as far as I'm aware. I never came across one. It's a relatively benign environment, actually, but it's utterly, utterly beautiful, particularly when you go by a river and then you get off the boat and you hang around. I've just totally fell in love. And then I saw what is being done to places like that. It's completely unbelievable. The destruction is everywhere. It's quite highland, as you can see, and then there's just a few little trees left. So after the trees are cleared, they prepare the land. This is a very early, relatively early stage, so at this point they've only terraced it. They haven't torn all of the undergrowth off. Next, they'll get all the rest of the undergrowth off and they'll plant the new trees. It's a very, very destructive process. Of course, what you end up with is this oil palm forest, which I also came to know very well because I'm a hasher. That doesn't mean I take hash. It's called Hash House Harriers. It began in Kuala Lumpur about 60, 70 years ago. It's an international running club. Well, some people say it's a running club with a drinking problem. Some people say it's a drinking club with a running problem. But the Hash House Harriers, we have a system which keeps the pack together. It's sort of area and tiering. So the idea is that the fast runners eventually have to find a trail, and that means the slow runners eventually catch them up. But you do sometimes get lost. When the whole landscape looks like that, there's no kind of, you know, it's just one trail after another for oil palm. There's no distinguishing features. So one hill in an oil palm terrace the same as another, whereas in a tropical rainforest, it's there is huge diversity. So you can remember, you know, one place from another by the different trees and so on. And of course, that's how local people have got around those forests for thousands of years. But it's very, very disorienting when you go into these monocultural environments, which are all around kale now. There's little bits of secondary jungle left, but I did get to know this environment quite well as well, from a kind of visceral running perspective in the early evening in the kale. So the forests of Borneo then essentially are being destroyed, their biodiversity, but also their human cultures are disappearing. And most concerningly, from a climate change perspective, the greenhouse gases in their biomass and soils are being released to the atmosphere as a result of the creation of these estates. I should have shown you a picture of the drainage channel, but if you've ever been there, you'll be familiar with them. So tropical rainforests are, as I'm sure many of you know, are hugely wet places, and a lot of the water remains in the soil, the surface soil, which is very thin, actually. But the humus plus the soil itself combined with water makes it very, very wet underfoot. You can't grow oil palm, which is from West Africa, used to much drier soils, on tropical rainforest soils as they are. You have to drain them first. And the drainage then, particularly if it's peatland, a lot of it is peatland as well. Some of it's peatland, but some of it isn't. But the point is, the drainage causes huge amounts of methane emissions as the soils dry out and the peat dries out. But of course, the companies, when they're selling biodiesel to Europe, don't include these emissions, the land conversion emissions, the drainage emissions, the drying emissions, let alone the peat fires. And there are underground peat fires in parts of Indonesia which they can't put out because they've been even more irresponsible in Sumatra than they have been in Borneo. Any putative claims, savings by putting 10% of biodiesel from plants into European vehicle tanks are completely wiped out by what's actually happening to the soil in these areas. The other thing that's very troubling, well, deeply troubling, is not only the destruction of traditional environment, but the way that local people are treated in the process. The Malaysian government takes the view that people who choose to live in forests are just mad, crazy, old-fashioned, primitive, stupid, unintelligent. I mean, I've seen far worse than that, and in the Malay words, of course, would be different again. Use of these people. When I lived in Malaysia, Mahathir Mohamad was the prime minister, and he would often come out with statements like, well, you know, we're not going to save the forest for those people. You didn't, and he'd also take the colonial thing. It's very clever. He'd say, well, you British, you can't come over here as environmentalists and start going on about our forests. You cut all your forests down 1,000 years ago. We're going to do that, and we're going to get rich too. You know, but the way local people were treated by the government is really horrendous, and by the oil palm companies. And some of the worst examples of the treatment are actual killings. I mean, the hundreds of environmental campaigners around the world, mostly local native people, not international, but local people, have been killed in tropical forests and in other precious parts of the world every year. And the death rate's gone up significantly in the last 10 years. And a number have been killed in Malaysia. So I just put an example here. Bill Keong, he was assistant to a Sarawak MP. He was defending a longhouse community from an oil palm company through a legal process. He was just killed in broad daylight in Miri with a gun out of a window on his motorbike by three men who were actually unusually tracked down, and one of them was an oil palm employee. And the newspaper reports say he was defending the writer Sungai Bukalit rather than nature. And this is a really important quote, and it's kind of central to what I want to say in the talk. But after his death, Sarawak's environmentalists joined land rights campaigns to voice their outrage. Environmentalists see longhouse communities and their defenders as the last hope for the state's dwindling forests. As loggers complete their destruction, trees are replaced by oil palm, one of the world's most ubiquitous and popular oil palm nation crops. So then there have been a spate of killing of these activists in the last few years, in drive-by shootings mostly. And it's typically the companies themselves who employ the people who do these things. But what I want you to note is the first quote. So traditional environmentalism saving the orangutan. I mean, that's been, if you look at WWF from sort of 80s, 90s kind of publicity about Borneo or Sumatra, it's about the orangutans. It's not about the people. But it's interesting that even the environmentalists now are beginning to get it. That if they focus on the remaining human communities and their legal and human rights, there's more chance of saving the forests near those communities than going on about orangutans. It's not that I don't like orangutans. I mean, Malay, orangutan means a person outside or in the jungle. So from a Malay perspective, an orangutan is almost a person, certainly in the language anyway. So they're amazing creatures. But the fact of the matter is environmental fetishization of endangered species and endangered habitats is not changing the behavior of world governments. But because they're all signed up to stuff like human rights and they pretend they at least have to put the semblance of acting on behalf of their citizens, if you demonstrate that destroying habitats destroys the lives of citizens, it's actually harder for them to carry on doing it. It doesn't mean they won't carry on doing it, but it's harder. So I think there's a very, very interesting point here about this shift from a focus on environmentalism to a focus on land rights. And the longhouses, obviously I've visited these myself, and many traditional practices continue. It's a remarkable way of life. In many ways, I think it's superior to the Western way of life, where you have, I mean, in Oxford, I've been cycling around quite a lot, and you have streets that are basically like, you know, car jungles. I mean, there is a law of jungle. I discovered that last night when I was actually assaulted by a van driver who didn't like the fact I was taking up the middle of the road, which is on the highway code you have a right to do on a bicycle, and the rear side is completely smashed in Oxford because they can't afford to maintain a road. So if you go on the rear side, on the near side of the pavement, you're liable to die in a pothole accident. If you go in the middle, I discover you're liable to get assaulted by a van driver. Well, anyway, this environment, on the other hand, the street is basically shared space. There are no vehicles here. People can all sit outside. Behind it, they have their own private space. Greek cities were very like this, in ancient Athens, for example. The Demos was outside. The politics was outside. People went in their houses for certain special things, obviously hygiene, cooking, and sleeping. But otherwise, most things were done outside. Whereas you look at the Western world now, the huge amounts of loneliness and separation, and you look at the pattern of the way we live, compare it to a longhouse, it's a superior way of life. But it's under threat from the destruction of the habitat which supports this way of life. And the main reason is because the land rights of the longhouse people, and the Iban, the Dayak, and the Penan, the three main groups, there are other groups, the three main groups in Sarawak are not recognized by the post-colonial, and I use that word advisedly, state government of Sarawak. So Malaysia is a federation of, 13 states? Yeah. 11 on West Malaysia, 2 in East Malaysia. The 2 in East Malaysia are like colonies to West Malaysia. So West Malaysia takes all the oil and gas from East Malaysia, and virtually all the money. There's one West Malaysian MP in the next election who's promising to give a bit more of the money to the East Malaysians, but I don't think he got a cat in hell's chance, as we say in England. But the result of this is, if you want to get rich and you're a government minister in East Malaysia, you've got to get rich for something else other than oil and gas. And they all want to get rich, so they get rich. This particularly Tayyip Mohammed, the chief minister for a ludicrously long time, nearly 30 years, has got incredibly rich from cutting down the rainforest. And it's very well documented. I'm not saying anything that isn't known outside these walls. I'm not afraid to say it because it's so well documented. Now, for me, the corruption and the destruction came home to me when I visited, I went up the Rajang River into what used to be called the 5th Division. Roger Brooke divided it all up into divisions, and they still have these names. We went to a logging town called, in the Balaga region called Kalapit, I think it was called. And while we were there, we met a flying doctor who we'd also met in Cebu before we got the boat. And she was going off in a helicopter into highland areas. And she told us that she was meeting families with malnutrition in Sarawak. And it's, I find it very hard to believe. This is the most, one of the most fertile places on Earth. You know, put a papaya seed in the ground and in 2 years you're going to have fruit. There are fruits just pouring off the trees. The idea that people are going, and the fish in the rivers, that people are going hungry, and that hungry in Sarawak, I just was astonished. And it's because their whole livelihood has been destroyed. Their livelihood, their habitat, everything has been taken away from them by the deforestation. Not only are the forests cut down, so then the mammals go, the areas that they plant their rice and their vegetables in go, but also the rivers fill up with this kind of pollution, with silt, and so all the fish die. So there's just nothing left for them to eat. Of course, the more internationally known feature of the destruction of the rainforest in Southeast Asia is this haze, which on in many summers, which is like known as the burning season, July, August, often through September, stretches from central Sumatra right across the peninsula, all the way to Borneo and even over to Java. I was there in the summer of 2013, for example, in Malacca, just here, so 20 miles. I went to sleep on a Saturday night. It was all quite normal. I woke up in the night and I could smell burning. And I was staying with a friend, a student who was then, who became a bishop. I knew he liked his whiskey, but I didn't know that he smoked. But anyway, I'm not very risk averse, so I just went back to sleep. But I got up in the morning, I opened the curtains, and you could only see about 20 feet down the street. And it smelled like a bonfire. It was a bonfire. They were just burning Sumatra. And Sumatra is now where Borneo was like 10, 20 years ago, in terms of the rate of land conversion. Now, of course, the EU directive mandates the use of biofuels in order to help the European community meet its international obligations to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And so, as he puts it, decarbonize transport fuel. And then, as it also puts it, reduce the life cycle gas, greenhouse gas emissions from the fuel and energy supply of European vehicles. Now, it does acknowledge that the incentives provided for in the directive will encourage increased production of biofuels worldwide. But it argues that increasing worldwide demand for biofuels and the incentives for their use provided for in this directive should not, it's an interesting word that in the end, should not have the effect of encouraging the destruction of biodiverse lands. And then it goes on, biofuel provision must be, procurement in other words, must be subject to sustainability criteria. And biofuels must not originate, sounds like Ten Commandments, doesn't it, in biodiverse areas, or threatened or endangered ecosystems or species, and primary forests should not be used to grow biofuels. But the trouble is they haven't come up with a system for ensuring that any of this actually happens. They've just created a market and let the market get on with it. They haven't regulated the market. So Ecuador in 2009 led, according to the trade association itself in oil palm, to a fivefold increase in the marketing of palm oil as biodiesel. And palm oil is the largest single plant source of European biodiesel. ECRED, in other words, incentivizes companies and national agencies to grow more biofuel and to continue to convert land areas to more production of crops with the potential to feed demand for biofuels, including forests and, of course, also grasslands, particularly in Brazil. The Commission argued that since primary forests are gazetted worldwide, this is in the original 2009 text, by government agencies, that it would be possible to prevent the marketing of biofuels from land converted from primary forests. But there's no mechanism or certification scheme to ensure that biofuels, which are liquids refined mostly in the country of origin and shipped thousands of miles to European ports and oil tankers, do not originate from lands that were formerly primary forests. So it's just not happening. So the origins of so much biofuel, biodiesel from primary tropical forests, and the claimed plants in biodiesel, the claim plants in biodiesel make it cleaner is a scandalous form of greenwash, I would argue, promulgated by the European Commission and the European Union, which of course we're going to leave, so I trust that Theresa May is going to end the use of biodiesel on the 20th of March 2019 in the United Kingdom, but I'm sure she won't. It is much like other things on her mind, I think, if she's still in power. It is made even more egregious when added to the vast amount of evidence that Volkswagen and EU vehicle regulators colluded. I mean, they worked together to reduce the laboratory emissions of diesel engines reported in vehicle technical reports, and Volkswagen went even further and installed software to full real-world vehicles. The point is, the European Commission refuses to have a test for diesel engines done on the street outside when they're being used as the basis for how you assess their greenhouse gas emissions. Even under the new regime, after the Volkswagen scandal, as a result of lobbying by, among others, the British government to protect our car industry, and of course mainly the German government, Angela Merkel, they insisted that they would still rely on laboratory tests of vehicles and not on real-world tests on roads. So frankly, Top Gear is a better judge of the performance of vehicles in the European Union than anything overseen by the European Commission. And I didn't vote to leave, I have to say. But anyway, but the other thing is, I mean, the greenwash then is added to the scandal that diesel is killing tens of thousands of Europeans every year, prematurely. So that you have the killing of people and species and forests in other lands, which is then used to greenwash the killing of Europeans. All of this because it's said to save CO2. So the focus of CO2 and fossil fuel emissions is highly, highly implicated in this whole saga. And really, this is an example of the ambiguity of environmental science. Actually, I'm going to come to that in a minute. But I get pretty exercised by this. One, because I've lived in Malaysia, and two, because I am mainly a cyclist. And I frequently find I literally just have to stop breathing. And sometimes, when I'm on my bike, but there's only so long that you can stop breathing if you're cycling. And I'm reasonably fit. But about a month ago, I was cycling down the middle. It was a mistake. I was a meeting in South London. I needed to get to King's Cross, and I hadn't left myself enough time. So instead of trundling through Hyde Park or something, going a long way around, I went straight through the middle, along Shaftesbury Avenue. And it felt like I was breathing pure diesel fumes. So I literally stopped breathing for as long as possible and rushed onto a side street. Anyway, I lived to tell the tale. This was actually a story in the New York Times today. It just came off my phone when I was writing the presentation. It's just sort of weird synergy. But they put 10 monkeys in a lab and then claimed to put diesel into the lab. But then it turns out that they didn't put very much diesel in the lab. So the lab test was, like all the other tests, actually a fake. Well, in Malaysia and in Indonesia, the effects of this have not stopped, even though it's internationally known, it's a scandal. The Singapore government now, you can get an app on your iPhone if you're a runner like me and you're in the region, you want to know, is it safe to go outside today? You look at the app. And they have this monitoring. This is a snap from their app. And they show you every day where it is. But you can, even now, even after all the destruction, it's still burning Sarawak. And then, of course, Sumatra is even bigger in terms of the current levels of burning. But of course, the Singapore government makes a lot of fuss. But the Singapore government is now the location of most of the Indonesian oil palm companies. They've all moved out of Indonesia to avoid government regulation and paying Indonesian taxes. So the Singapore Stock Exchange carries a lot of value as a result of the burning of the forests, about which sometimes it complains on behalf of its citizens. So anyway, all of this obviously is not completely unknown in Europe. Greenpeace, Oxfam, etc. There was even a piece on the BBC apparently the other night about all this. So they published a revision, the Commission, in 2015, requiring that companies wanting their biofuels to become part of the EU liquid fuels mix should sign up to legal or voluntary schemes to ensure their products are not from recently cleared forests. Now, in the case of oil palm, the only internationally recognised scheme for ensuring oil palm is not produced from land converted recently from primary forests, I think something like 12 years or something, is the Round Table on Sustainable Palm Oil, otherwise known as RSPO. Now, in the 2013 burning season, in this area, a number of the fires were started on land closely contiguous to plantations claiming to produce sustainable palm oil for the Roundtable on Sustainable Palm Oil Certification Scheme. And it seems quite clear that those fires were set by subcontractors, employed by subcontractors, on behalf of the companies who want to extend their plantations. So, there is, of course, as I just said, growing recognition. The European Biofuels Directive is having some rather malign effects, and that as a result of these, it's actually not doing what it claims. It's not reducing the greenhouse gas emissions consequent on the size of Europe's vehicular fleet. In fact, it's probably, and almost certainly, increasing them. So NGOs like Oxfam, Greenpeace, and there are a number of scientific studies have also demonstrated this, that this led to a debate in the European Parliament in which MEPs passed a motion in 2017 calling on the European Commission to remove all vegetables, including palm oil, from European biofuel by 2020. But the Commission has not responded. For those of you who don't know, the European Parliament is not like the British Parliament. And that's not for the obvious reasons, but it's because the European Parliament cannot propose legislation. All the European Parliament can do is debate things that are already happening or things that are proposed by the Commission. And if it wants anything to change, it has to try to persuade the Commission to change things. So that's one of the big democratic deficits to me in Europe. The answer to the way to change is to fight for change, not to leave. But anyway, that's another mess. The point is, I think it's highly unlikely the European Commission will act on this. Why? Because if they do, they'll be taken to the World Trade Organization Court, which is an international jurisdiction body run by various corporate lawyers, and they'll probably be found in contravention of the WTO rules, because Malaysia and Indonesia claim to certify that their biodiesel is produced sustainably and results in lower greenhouse gas emissions than fossil fuels, and so they'll fight for it, and of course they've already warned that they'll do that. Now, I suppose it's rather obvious what I say here. This is an ecological disaster. It's affecting species, but it's also affecting people. Hundreds of thousands of Malaysians have had their livelihoods destroyed by this, and many of them lived ancestrally, at least their families have lived ancestrally for hundreds, in many cases thousands of years in these forests. Now, there's a Malaysian customary law called Adat, which recognises such indigenous ancestral rights, but this customary law is not recognised in the formal state law courts in Sarawak. And so whenever the tribal peoples have tried to fight their corner in these courts, they have not been heard and they have not succeeded in their cases. The judiciary in Malaysia are very much controlled and appointed and fired in such a way that they don't challenge the government if they possibly can avoid it. In Sarawak, then, what's actually happened, instead of the native peoples being recognised as the trustees of the forest, is that the chief minister appointed himself as the trustee of the forest for 60 years. And that appointment has resulted in the growth of a huge property empire, which one study puts at 15 billion in total. A number of companies around the world. This is a book by a man called Straumann, published in Switzerland, called Money Logging in 2014. Well, it's a group of Penan people. It's a fairly contemporary photograph. Some of them are still living and living well, but far fewer of them, and many of them are now confined in kind of government or cement and tin huts and so on. But of course, the destruction of the forests has led them ultimately to protest and as the only way left to try to protect themselves. And the classic way they did this was that photograph I showed you at the beginning of non-violent. They've always endeavoured to be non-violent. Non-violent logging road blockades. And these have actually been quite successful. They tend to be respected by the local employees of the companies, who are connected to other local people. So the companies then get very exercised. They then threaten the headman, the longhouse headman, and try to get at them that way. And in some cases, as I've said, some headmen have just disappeared and ultimately been found to have been killed violently. One of the people who arguably had a role in encouraging this strategy was, however, a European environmentalist, a guy called Bruno Manser. Some of you might have heard of him. He's a Swiss adventurer who lived extensively with the Penan in the 1990s, campaigned on their behalf internationally, including in Brussels, by the way. But he was then outlawed as an illegal by the Sarawakian government. And he disappeared one day on land belonging to Samling, which is the largest oil palm company. And nobody has ever found his remains. Nobody knows what happened to him. Now, one thing that they have done, in addition to the logging blockades, is to try to map the area. And there's a very large indigenous mapping project now going on with the support of various European and foundations and of Malaysians. But the Sarawak government hadn't answered that too. They then outlawed anybody making maps, except officials of the Sarawak government. Now that goes back again to British times. When we used to do the hatch, it was quite difficult to get hold of maps because in the emergency, which was the longest war Britain ever fought, so the emergency in Malaya lasted from 1945 roughly to independence in 1957, and the leader of the communists didn't finally emerge from the jungle until I think it was the mid to late 80s. In fact, I think it was when I was there. But that war meant that maps were kind of government property, because if they fell into the hands of people who you weren't sure were on your side, then they could fight you more effectively. So it was often difficult to hold a map. So it's not unfamiliar, but, well, you're geographers. So who writes the maps? Who controls the maps? Who does the surveys? I mean, the first survey in Britain, the Ordnance Survey, why is it the Ordnance Survey? What's ordnance mean in the English language? What's an ordnance? What's an ordnance?
Military hardware.
It's a weapon. Military hardware. So the first map, the Ordnance Survey of Britain, was military hardware, military software, in order, and it was begun to put down the Highland Risings, because that was an independent source of violence against the new post-Union British state, and they needed to never let them rise again. So mapping, it's very political. So here's Mansa sitting with his pen and friends, and they sort of acknowledged him as one of their own and made a memorial to him. Now, I've said a few things already about what's been going on there, but this is a statement from a formal document, which was an inquiry into what's happened in Sarawak, where it's quite clear that the so-called Land Custody Development Authority, set up by Tan Mahmud, is appointed in Malaysia for 60 years as the trustee on behalf of, it says, the trustee for the natives for 60 years. And obviously it's not been a trustworthy trustee on their behalf, because they've lost their homes and their livelihood. So from my perspective then, and not just from my perspective, this is a quote from Singh, her rather amazing book, Friction. She's based in California, I think, geographer. The interaction between criminality and corruption, primary forest exploitation and wealth accumulation, is facilitated through international financial agencies and technologies. So again, Europe's involved not just in the biofuels, but in enabling all this stuff to happen. So one of the most shocking examples of this was that Deutsche Bank raised, Taib, the chief minister, a 700 million bond issue, which he used to invest, to create and invest capital in companies that he and his family owns, and in particular oil palm and tropical logging companies. So international capital and international finance provide a very clever mechanism globally, technologically enabled, putatively governed by the big accounting firms, etc., to convert that land and the power to license logging into property, capital, investments, clean it up. I mean, the London property market's well known as one of the biggest laundries in the world for this purpose. The other problem there, it seems to me, is not just the role of capital and finance in all this, but is the role of science. Climate science, environmental science, is used to promote biofuels as a response to climate change. And it provides, in so doing, opportunities for capital to turn primary forest into money. Under the UNFCCC, nations agree to produce inventories of national greenhouse gas emissions from their territories. But these inventories, of course, become sites of mediation and manoeuvring by national governments in pursuit of their national interests. So the Malaysian government, in its inventory, considers oil palm places as forests, so it can reduce the amount of emissions attributable to its plantations, because they're not really plantations, they're forests, so they don't produce emissions, they save emissions because they're producing biofuel. So the whole inventory process, a bit like the mapping process, who's in control of it? Who collects the data? What data is collected? Who decides, you know, what's an emission and what's not an emission? But the amount of forest that is being converted is huge, and Sarawak official statistics indicate, nonetheless, that 64% of the land there was still forest in 2010. And this is a huge overestimate. If you've ever flown over Sarawak or Sabah, you just know this is a ludicrous claim. The problem is that the conventional scientific narrative of climate change focuses on emissions from coal, gas, and oil as the principal climate forcer. So the European Commission then uses greenhouse gas accounting modes of representation, which make it seem as though useful biofuel, as opposed to fossilized biofuel, so that's useful fuel from photosynthesis on present-day plants, though grown on ancestral lands, has a lower climate impact than the old photosynthesis on ancient plants and shellfish represented by fossil fuels. So you see, there's a very interesting issue of temporality or chronology in all of this. So we're not only there's not only a spatial dimension, but a very, very interesting temporal dimension. How we narrate time, scientifically, in the fuel cycle, in the energy cycle, becomes hugely significant. And one of the things I've been studying recently is how environmental activists understand time when they try to be more sustainable. I just had a big project in Aptar about to start work on writing up. Now the EC assumes national inventories of primary forests are diligently kept by government, so the carbon stays in the ground. And so they just assume biofuels are young, they're not polluting, and it's not a problem. So essentially then, science justifies the new uses to which land is put as climate friendly. And the governments of Malaysia, Indonesia, and plantation companies use science also in their modes of representation of greenhouse gases embedded in the biodiesel, and they emit emissions from land use change, fires, drainage, and so on. So the mode of representation of greenhouse gases in biofuels uses it and relies on science in their accounting and underestimates the climate forcing impact of fossil fuels. But of course, when the customer buys diesel at a European gas station, which you saw because it contains plants, and they often show you a picture of plants by the tank. You know, you get your thing out, and there's a nice green plant there. Oh, it must be all right. Science and the European Commission are looking after it. I can just carry on driving. I don't have to worry. It's all being done for me. But actually, scientists reckon that climate forcing impact of biofuels is 50 to 100% higher than conventional fossil fuels. I don't know about tar sands. So, juxtaposed against crony and international capital and science-informed accounts of biofuels and greenhouse gas emissions are the traditions, customs, and beliefs of scientifically uninformed native peoples whose ancestral forests are being destroyed to grow the young plants needed for increased global production of biofuels. The shared assumption among nation politicians and scientific foresters is that indigenous people are not good guardians or managers of forests. One of my favourite books we were discussing at lunchtime is James Scott, Seeing Like a State. People don't know how to look after stuff, only scientists do, preferably employed by governments. However, in Sarawak, the only areas that have been saved from the destruction outside of the gazetted boundaries of national parks, which constitute 6.6% of the forested areas, are areas protected from deforestation by the non-violent logging blockades and oil palm resistant activities of the Penang. Those are the only areas that have been protected. The biggest area is this highland area in northeast Sarawak, which is now known as the Penang Peace Park. And it's being preserved by an extraordinary amount of non-violent activity and organisation, mainly by Penang people, but not exclusively. And democratic deliberation and meetings like this, and signs and claims that they're creating a new law and that it ought to be preserved. And finally, there is some recognition. Taib has moved on as the chief minister, and the new chief minister are trying to apparently curry some favour with the locals. So the Borneo Post reports on July 13th, 2016, that an area contiguous to Benampi's farm is now recognised as set aside. It's not a national park, but it's not going to be logged, and it's not going to be turned into oil palm. It's going to be co-managed, extraordinary, co-managed by local people who live there and the Sarawak state government. So there is hope, but there's not a huge amount of hope. There's not a huge amount left of the old forest. So from my perspective, the example of the Pennine highlights a broader problem of what Agrawal calls environmentality, which is the tendency of environmental, atmospheric and species conservation science and agreements to be used to impose governance regimes on peoples, creatures and habitats in which agency is denied to the ancestral dwellers of such habitats, human and non-human. The limited success of the Pennine in resisting their ancestral forests being logged and turned into plantations is an example of why Courtney Young, in another book, calls what she calls the moral force of indigenous politics. Essentially, by resisting a post-colonial regime which is stealing their land and destroying their homes, the Pennine claim to be subjects on their own terms in Western East Malaysia, even as the nomads that they have always been. And in so doing, they challenge the idea that normal citizens have to live in houses with the roofs on that are fixed and have a cement block and tin roofs and foundations. And they're having a limited success in that now. But there's a broader issue that I want to end thinking about. Bruno Latour argues that the modern environmental science lacks sufficient focus on the public sphere because it has not found ways to include creatures' voices in public assemblies and courts. Obviously, it will be difficult to do so, and because we know that we know pigs have sophisticated languages. I've got a friend who works in Edinburgh. But they don't vocalise as we do. I mean, admittedly, sometimes what you hear in the Australian Parliament and even sometimes in the British sounds a bit like that kind of vocalisation, but it's not supposed to, right? But the point that Latour is making is that the Pennine, misses that the Pennine are not environmentalists, but they're not animals either. But if their voices had been included in the courts and in the parliaments, the disruption would not have happened. So perhaps he's got the wrong target in his politics of nature in saying we need to get the non-human into parliament. If we'd have got representatives of all the humans, and not only the developed or the claimed to be developed humans, we might be in a different place. But of course, the Pennine's environmentalism is not the conventional kind of environmentalism. It's what Juan Martí Zanetti Allier calls the environmentalism of the poor. It's not about tree-hugging. They love trees. But it's more about what I call in a book that I wrote in the 90s after these experiences, environmental justice, which I argue is a very ancient idea that you find in the Hebrew Bible. And interestingly, in Laudato Si, Pope Francis makes very similar points. Always nice when a pope finally gets around to agreeing with you. And he actually also makes the point that the environmental crisis, first and foremost, is actually a human crisis. And that if you address the human crisis, you will then also be able to address the crisis of other creatures and the crisis of habitat and climate. But if you forget that it's about people, you won't fix it. And it's really interesting that that's in Laudato Si. Now, the other person that I find very helpful in all this is an anthropologist called Roy Rappaport, who's one of my favourites. I never met him, never even heard him lecture, but he wrote this one. He did this wonderful paper in Science in 1967. It's called Pigs for the Ancestors, and then he wrote a book about it. And his study of the Sembarga of Papua New Guinea, he theorized, and then he produced some data, that an annual pig sacrifice ceremony had the effect, which had a clear religious function in the community, in a kind of Dakinian sense, the big, 2 week sort of Christmas-like, bacchanalian festival. But at the same time, it had the effect of keeping the numbers of pigs kept, which is they're not a native animal, they were domesticated them, so there were more than there should have been, keeping the numbers within the carrying capacity of the ecosystem or the villages where the pigs were. So he was the first, I think, to make a connection between religio-cultural rituals, customs and traditions and carrying capacity and ecosystem services and all of that. And I think his work is really quite remarkable. And he went on to develop in a book towards the end of his life in which he argued that the role of religion is to mediate between what is made and what is not made. This is Vico, of course, the first anthropologist. so as to facilitate adaptation of human making, including the making of meaning and natural laws and the unmade, to the natural environment in ways that doesn't produce the kind of destruction we're seeing in Borneo. However, religion can fail. It can become pathological. And it may then play a role, as Jared Diamond famously argues, but I think mistakenly, actually, about Easter Island. The evidence is rather different to what he argues in the book Collapse. But nonetheless, religion may play a role in ecosystem collapse. But then we would argue, at least Rappaport would, it's become pathological. In Rappaport's terms, the adoption of biofuels as a response to climate change is a sort of post-religious pathology to support the dominant ritual of Europe, which is shopping, the religion, particularly shopping for cars, the religion of consumerism. And it's part of a larger tendency of science and technologies and late modernity to fashion meanings and symbol systems which come to displace the prehistoric and historic role of religions in mediating between the unknown and the known, the made and the mysterious. Now, there are a few more slides. I'll run through these really quickly. There's a famous thing called the Sarawak Law. Alfred Russel Wallace developed in his Malay Archipelago. He developed it before Darwin published The Origin of Species, but they started corresponding. Darwin became aware Wallace was going to publish, so he rushed to get The Origin of Species out and beat Wallace to it. But interestingly, so he was trying to work out, you know, what's the cause of the variation in distribution of species in Sarawak. And then he tried to theorize globally on the basis of that. He summarizes theory as follows. Every species comes into existence coincident, both in space and time, with a pre-existing, closely aligned species. It's a very, very different theory. It's more like a Kropotkin-type theory of evolution than a Darwinian theory, because it suggests that mutuality, enabling us as a fundamental driver, rather than competition. So Kropotkin lived in the Russian steppe. He did his observations there. Darwin lived on a tiny island. On a small island like this, particularly with the number of people there are now, this competition is huge between different species. You go to places where there's huge amounts of land, there are a relative number of species, mutuality becomes... Anyway, but the point is, Wallace's law, the crucial thing about it is, it left out the influence of Homo sapiens. Like Darwin, he's saying, what we see is a result of nature's laws, not of human behavior. This is wrong. What you see in the forests, in the jungles, of Malaysia, of the Amazon, John Muir went there and made the same mistake, and of course he made the same mistake in the Yosemite, which led to the native peoples being excluded when they set up the national park, and then about 20 years later, the park service realized that things were happening, didn't used to happen, and they realized, oh, those people used to do stuff that was quite useful. So they had to create wardens who did the same things, employed by the US federal government. So we have to put human beings, Homo sapiens, back into the picture. That's my point. They were the guardians of biodiversity in Borneo for 14,000 years, roughly, before Wallace got there. So what was there was a result of their guardianship. But the Malaysian state has just said, they're ignorant, they know nothing. We're the guardians, we're the trustees, we can make money from this. We can grow capital, we can develop the country, do all these wonderful things, build a larger airport. Third airport near Kuala Lumpur, well, there almost is one now. So, finally, one more book. I just totally love this book. I almost cried when I cried when I read it. Robin Hanbury Tenzin, A Journey to the Heart of Eden, of Borneo, Finding Eden. It is a journal account, almost blow by blow. It's got his journal in it. But then the first half is a kind of reflection looking back of a Royal Geographical Society expedition to Mulu, which found the great caves, the great back caves, the cathedral-like caves in Mulu, and there's now a national park around those caves. It's amazing. But while he was there, he was befriended by a Penan family. And he came to realize, as a result of that friendship, the huge amount of work that native people were doing to conserve this environment and how much they understood it. He said that the Penan are the key reason there is so much biodiversity in Sarawak. And it's this which makes the forest so valuable and worth turning into a park. Is that there have been people looking after it in a symbiotic relationship for ages. And what is more, as we were increasingly to learn on our expedition, their knowledge and understanding of it far exceeded our own superficial scientific analysis. Now, essentially, I think that Ekred reveals an ontological misunderstanding of time. It just assumes, you know, the modern idea of progress. We're on an upward path. People living in forests are kind of, you know, that's the past. And we've got nothing to learn from the past about how to live in the Anthropocene, how to live in the future. But it's also a misunderstanding in terms of the relationship between short-term and medium-term temporalities in climate governance and financial capital and oil from fossil fuels and oil from new photosynthesis on old soils. The Penan and other indigenous people live by a temporality that I call ancestral time. They govern their lands and raise their children and guard their fellow creatures as their ancestors have done for millennia. They do this from present-day photosynthesis, since the materials they use are almost exclusively from the jungle itself. So paradoxically, their ancestral time also promotes a presentist temporality in relation to energy production and use. And we have to do the same. We have actually still to learn from these people how to create this real-time energy which doesn't destroy the future planet by burning old fossil fuels or ruining old soils. And that's the heart of it. It's a temporality problem, the energy supply business. And we're finding that, of course, in the technology of batteries. That's a temporality problem. But there's a much deeper temporality problem in the way that money interacts with the global energy supply system. We need to address that if we're going to fix this problem. Well, it's just a list of references. It's a bit short, small, but in case you're wanting to follow some of them up. Thank you very much for listening. I hope you've got some questions, and I realize I've been a little controversial, but I find it hard to get on public and not be controversial. So, fine. Thank you very much.